This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by CERT Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 93rd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Yoshi Kono. Hi, Yosh.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Yoshi Kono is an associate professor in computer science and engineering department at the University of Washington and an adjunct associate professor in the UW Information School. His research often garners widespread attention. It focuses on computer security for emerging and consumer technologies, security and privacy for mobile and cloud systems, the human element in computer security systems, and computer security education. Yoshi is also a Cigital alum from 2001. He lives with his wife, Taryn, and their two boys in Washington State. Thanks for joining us today, Yosh.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be talking with you today.
So you've been a consultant, a graduate-level cryptographer, a professor. How much impact does academic security have on the commercial world, and what are you doing about that?
That's a good question. I think that there's a broad range of research that's being done in academia, but I think in academia we have the potential to have huge impact in industry. That's not to say that every project we do has a lot of impact, but you know, there are a few diamonds in the rough. Maybe one of the examples that's kind of most recent on my mind is the work we did on automotive security, both at UW and in collaboration with UC San Diego,
right,
where we purchased two automobiles and experimentally tried to understand their vulnerabilities and then disseminated the results of our research. And that has had a tremendous amount of impact within the automotive industry and even within governments, too.
Yeah, that was very cool. What was the exact kind of car that you bought there?
That's a very good question. So one thing I will say is that for this particular line of research, we did not actually publicly disclose the make and model of the vehicle. We did
you can see it on Nova, though.
So experts in the field definitely can identify the car, but we didn't want to, in the research paper, we didn't want to draw specific attention to that vehicle,
uh-huh,
because we actually thought this might be an industry-wide issue, that not just this one manufacturer needs to think about security, but in fact, you know, all the automotive manufacturers really do need to think about security.
Oh, I think that's pretty clear. So I didn't really want to out them. I just wanted to giggle about the kind of car that it was.
Yeah, no. People can figure out, and I definitely understood your question. But, yeah.
Not telling is the answer.
That's right.
So who bought that? Was that grant money that was used to purchase the cars?
That's a great question. So we bought two cars. One was purchased by UCSD, uh-huh, and I'm not sure what their source of funding was. The other one that we purchased at the University of Washington was with I had an Alfred Sloan Fellowship, and that was kind of discretionary funds that I could use to further my research in any direction that I thought was appropriate.
Right.
And so I used the Sloan Foundation funds for.
So did you end up bricking the car in the long term?
I mean, we actually did not end up bricking the car.
That's good.
We just actually did a demo of the vehicle last week where many of the attack capabilities still work. So, yeah, our car is still there. We were very cautious with their experiments.
I know that Charlie Miller has been screwing around with cars, and I think he's bricked a couple.
Yeah, I'm not sure what his source of funds were and how much funds he has, but we were cautious not to brick ours.
Dude, it's the Twitter IPO. That's his source of funds.
Ah, that's right.
So most of your publicized work involves hacking things that normal people use every day, like cars. You just talked about medical devices and toys and garage door openers and dishwashers and so on. Tell us more about this car hacking work that was covered by the New York Times and Nova. And, first of all, like, what motivated your lab to look into cars in the first place?
That's a great question. So you mentioned a large number of topics, things like, medical devices and automobiles and so on. And I think that one of the underlying themes within our lab is to try to figure out what will be the hot new technology over the next 5, 10, or 15 years that might have potential security privacy issues. And can we start looking at those technologies now so that we can kind of have a leg up on the adversary, so that we as academics and also as the industry and the government, can we proactively address security issues? And so what drew us to automobiles was really the observation that the modern automobile is becoming pervasively computerized. Mm-hmm. And I can go into a little bit of detail about why that's happening and the numerous benefits for computerization.
Sure, please do.
But as a result of that, it does raise the question, well, what if one of these components in the automobile is compromisable?
Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's a target-rich environment because everything is becoming internetized, so to speak.
That's right. So, it's a target-rich environment because everything is becoming connected to the internet. You know, we call it people are calling it the Internet of Things. One thing that I will say is that even though many of the devices connected to the Internet of Things can be compromised, you know, that doesn't actually necessarily mean that, you know, the risk is high.
Right. So, of course.
Yep. So I think one of the things that, you know, you and I used to say all the time, we used to talk about when we were at Cigital, is that, you know, there's no such thing as perfect security. You know, everything is vulnerable to some attackers and secure against other attackers. But one of the things that we try to understand in our research by experimentally analyzing a real artifact is what is the actual state of security of this technology so we can make an informed decision.
Yeah.
Then
you can also do back-end things to reduce the risk. For, you know, you'll recall back in the days we were working on smart cards stuff together. And, you know, you could break every card. It wasn't that they were not broken. They were. But as long as you could use fraud detection capabilities in the back-end, that breaking didn't really matter in some cases.
No, that's an incredibly good observation. And that is one of the, you know, the same observation applies to the automotive environment. So I haven't actually described the vulnerabilities that we uncovered and, you know, our actual adversarial capabilities, but there are numerous kind of, as you say, fraud detection techniques that automotive manufacturers could do on the back end to detect people either mounting an attack or even people who are exploring the attack surface trying to develop attack capabilities.
So all I've read so far about your car hacking stuff is pretty much popular press. Can you be a little more technical about exactly what you did, maybe in the situation where you were doing the brake controller?
Sure, yeah. So I'll start at a very high level. At the highest level, our work was focused into two phases. And so to describe the first phase, the important background information is that the modern car is pervasively computerized, and the computers within the car are interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And there are numerous valuable reasons for this. For example, I could have a computer on each of the wheels that is detecting how fast the wheels are spinning. They would send a message to another computer on the car that would determine if one wheel is spinning faster than the other, which might be a sign that you're entering into a skid. And then they would send a message to the brake computer, telling the brake computer to slow down, say, the back right wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And then that will get you out of the skid and provide traction control.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the interconnection of the computers on the automobile. They're talking with each other, and they have numerous safety purposes. And you also just saw in that example how that computer network was connected to the brake controller, which had the ability to control the brakes.
Right.
So in the first phase of our research, we said, what might an attacker be able to do if they could somehow connect to the car's internal computer network? You know, that's a big if, but we, you know, actually plug a device onto the car's internal computer network and say, what could that device do?
Did you just tap the bus in that case?
So actually, there's a federally mandated port underneath the dash,
uh-huh,
called the OBD2 port, the onboard diagnostics port,
yep,
and it's federally mandated for mission test and testing purposes. And so we could actually just plug directly into that port underneath the dash.
That's hilarious.
federally mandated
hacker port.
Exactly, yep. You know, as with all these things, you know, there are, you know, both benefits and potential risks. And so for us, we said if we could connect to that port, what could we do?
Right.
And then for that, there were several phases. The first phase that are probably familiar to some of your listeners is just eavesdropping. And so what we did was we would sit in the car and we would turn on the lights and we would sniff the packets being sent over that internal network and we would say, that packet was sent when we turned on the lights.
Right. So then you can do a playback attack.
That's right. So we would do a playback attack. And that gave us the capability to kind of on our own, you know, whenever we wanted to mimic any sort of operation that we saw on the vehicle during normal course of use.
So they weren't using nonces and freshness or anything clever.
I don't recall actually if they were. I don't believe they were, but, you know, there was nothing cryptographic certainly that prevented us from just kind of replaying packets whenever we wished.
Right.
That gave us, you know, pretty significant control. I mean, we could set the speedometer to whatever we want. We could turn all the lights off if we want, including the brake lights, so that, you know, if, you know, driving at night, you know, when someone hits the brake, they don't see anything, no lights in the car, and when someone presses the brake, we see absolutely nothing, and so on. But there was another class of capabilities that we wanted to explore, which was, you know, actually doing things like disabling the brakes,
right,
or forcibly engaging the brakes.
Right.
And for that, you know, we wouldn't see those messages sent over the car's internal network during normal course of operation. You know, that's just not something you will see normally happen. So we basically used fuzzing.
Right.
And so what we did for that is we, you know, made specially crafted packets that were kind of, you know, constrained in some areas, but then had random data in other areas, and just sent the packets over the car's internal network, and then observed what happened. And it was through that process that we learned how to forcibly disengage the brakes, so that if someone puts pressure on the brake pedal, the brakes do not actually engage.
Right.
And we also learned how to create packets that would forcibly engage the brakes, so that if someone was driving, the brakes would just suddenly lock up on them.
Right. So all this involves access to the bus directly. Now, how did you access the thing through a wireless transmission?
That is a great question. So for the second phase of our research, we wanted to say, how might someone gain access to this car without ever physically touching it? And we actually found maybe four or five different ways to do that. And, you know, I'll start with what I think was one of the cutest ones. Is that our car radio is connected to, our car CD player is connected to the car's internal computer network. And we found two problems with the car's CD player, one of which was in the way that the car CD player handled WMA audio files.
Uh-huh.
And so we could actually give us any song, we could run it through the scripts that would produce a WMA file that would play perfectly fine on a Windows machine or a Mac machine.
Uh-huh.
But if you run it to a CD and put that CD in our car, our demo CD plays Beethoven 9th, but you put it in our car doors will unlock. But we could run it from there.
That's pretty funny. They didn't show that one on TV.
No, they didn't show that one. But I think that's, you know, kind of, to me, that's actually particularly interesting because there's been a lot of focus on the external wireless interface.
Right.
But we really actually need to think about all interfaces, you know, even something as simple as a CD player. Now, the risk for this might be low, but, you know, it is still worth keeping in mind that type of, you know, I post a WMA file on the internet, you know, someone downloads it, burns it to a CD, and puts it in their car, you know, this type of thing can happen.
Right. So you got to consider the entire attack surface is another way to put that.
Yes, exactly. Another one was the diagnostics tool at the service shop. So we purchased the manufacturer-recommended diagnostics tool, mm-hmm. and these are the things that the technicians will plug into your car if you bring your car into service because one of the lights are on.
Right.
That piece of equipment actually had Wi-Fi and was vulnerable. So we were able to inject our own code onto those diagnostics tools,
right,
which would then be able to inject code into any vehicle that it connected to later.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a yawner.
Yeah, perhaps, but it's, you know, to me, I think it's interesting because then we really, is in another example of having to think about the whole ecosystem, not just the vehicle, but, you know, the entire service facility.
Of course. I mean, you know, if you were a spy, if you were James Bond, that's who you'd go after.
Yeah, and then maybe the final one that I think is kind of the one that I believe they've shown on, you know, the Nova and so on, was cellular interface. So our car, purchased off of the lot, has basically a built-in cell phone.
Right.
And these are, you know, this is, you know, all of the major manufacturers have these type of things. They're called telematics units.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is that they allow the car to effectively call 911 if you get in an accident. And so, there's, again, like with many things, like with traction control and everything else, there's numerous safety benefits for having these telematics systems.
Right.
But because our car has this built-in telematics unit that can call 911 if it gets in an accident, it means it has a cell phone inside it, which means that we can also call our car's phone number.
Right.
And so once we call our car's phone number, we found that we could play the appropriate tone to switch to the in-band modem. And then we can, using the in-band modem, we can exploit an authentication vulnerability. And then once you exploit an authentication vulnerability, we can inject a very small payload to do a buffer overflow to get our own code running on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it was a pretty interesting series of things that you had to do to get the exploit to work. Each is like a little toehold when you're climbing the mountain.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yes, so there was a number of steps. I mean, for example, if that authentication vulnerability didn't exist, we wouldn't have been able to, do the buffer overflow vulnerability. One of the interesting things for us was that, you know, this basically the the telematic service in the car, again, unmodified car, bought, purchased off the lot, basically runs a variant of Unix. Mm-hmm. And so our little bit of payload code would then fire off, would start running on the car and actually fire off an FTP, call to FTP, because FTP was actually, you know, available on the telematics unit.
Yeah, nice.
The car has a cell phone, has 3G data, and so, you know, internet was on. We did an FTP connection to an FTP server at the University of Washington, which would then download another a much larger program to run in the car. That other program was an IRC client. We'd start that IRC client, which would then connect to our command and IRC channel at UW, and basically, you know, the cars that we would call became part of our IRC botnet.
That's hilarious. I love it. So this has a very important lesson for security engineering, which is worth bringing up, and that is, if you just block one of the possible attack paths by, say, making sure that that one buffer overflow didn't work, there are still a whole bunch of other vulnerabilities which in the future could be accessed in a different path to cause the same sort of problem.
I think that is a great lesson. And there were actually a number of lessons that we tried to pull out, one of which was, you know, exactly the one that you mentioned. Another one is that for many embedded environments, they have not received adversarial pressure yet, and so they have not learned the things that, like, Windows learned, Microsoft learned in the 1990s.
Yeah, they haven't done the basics, is another way of putting it.
Yeah, and, you know, and so, you know, yeah, exactly. So one of the ways I like to put it is that if we have a computer company that has, you know, learned the hard way that security is an important issue, and they move into an emerging space, you know, I think that they will be proactively thinking about security. But when you have another industry, maybe it's automotive, maybe it's medical, maybe it's home automation, that has really been, you know, very, very, or children's toys even, very, very good at their discipline, you know, they suddenly start, hey, let's bring in computers, let's bring in wireless, it sounds great. They haven't learned the hard way to think about security, and therefore their systems kind of suffer from the same vulnerabilities that Microsoft and others learned to address again in the mid-1990s.
Yeah, so all these major news stories that you guys have come up with share one thing in common, and that is a spectacular hack of some sort. So how do you get the media to cover good software and system security?
That is a great question.
Well, the major news outlets love explosions. This is the NASCAR effect. You know, you watch NASCAR so you can watch somebody crash and maybe die, and it's spectacular. Nobody watches just to see cars go around in a circle. And that's the you know, so people are attracted to stories of disaster and stories of hacking and exploits, but they're not attracted to a story about how great the security engineering is or how well some company's doing building their products.
I believe that's, you know, I think you're right, and I'm not, you know, there's several answers to your question. One answer kind of comes back to the research we did in the sense that we were actually very concerned that the media would take the results we had and actually blow them out of proportion.
Right.
You know, because, you know, the work we did require some amount of technical sophistication. You know, the risks today actually are probably pretty small to people. I mean, I don't know of any incident of this actually happening at all in the wild, you know, security threats.
Just wait.
So, you know, so we actually tried to downplay our own story because we were worried about this, the explosion threat.
So, but it's not just hyperbole that I'm worried about. I'm worried about teaching people good engineering because...
Yep.
Focus on attacks and over-focus on attacks leads people to believe that the way that you secure a system is you just attack it a lot and fix everything you find. But that's a very silly way to go about doing security engineering, as you know.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I know we have actually had some success with you know, media looking at our educational efforts. So one of the things that we are, you know, really, I'm very, very passionate about is trying to figure out new ways to teach computer security. And there's a lot of different things that we might want to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So we might want to teach, you know, technical defenses, like, you know, this is, you know, how you protect against a cross-site scripting attack, and this is how, you know, these are some methods for cross-site request forgery and so on.
Yep.
The thing that I have been very passionate about teaching is kind of a layer below that, which, you know, we call the, you know, people call either the professional paranoia, some people call the security mindset. You know, I prefer the latter term. And the idea here is to try to teach people how to, or maybe backing up a little bit, when many people see a new system or a new product, they say, oh, that product's great, I can't wait to use it. Someone with a security mindset, when they see a new product, says, oh, wow, that product looks great. I can't wait to use it. But I also am very curious, how might I abuse it? What
exactly.
might go?
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So you believe, I assume, that you can teach somebody to think like an attacker.
I believe that I can teach people, give people enough insight into the security mindset so that when they go into industry and they start working on their own products, they have this little bit of a, you know, security mindset kind of sitting on their shoulder, just kind of, you know, a little bit of a buzz. And so that when something that has a potential security issue arises, maybe they themselves don't know how to address it, but they're aware of the fact that there might be an issue so that they can bring in, you know, outside experts. Maybe,
yeah, so,
you know,
so the question is whether that is sort of an innate talent that you have to develop or whether you can really teach anyone to do that. And there's a lot of debate among even us practitioners about that sort of thing. What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. So I think there's varying levels of this skill. And I think that, you know, it's partly, I believe that it can be taught, but I believe also that there, you know, some people are kind of more natural at it than others. And I don't know if we can bring everyone to like kind of a level of expertise that a security expert would have, but I do think we can teach people to, you know, have a little bit more of the security mindset in mind. And the way that I believe we do this is that most people have, you know, many people don't have this mindset to begin with, but if we show them through examples and have them work through a few cases where these surprising things arise, then I think that they kind of just like open a new door, and that at least they're aware of that, you know, they become more aware of these issues.
I think that's right, but I want to push on this a little further. So let's assume that you can teach somebody to notice that something's broken. That doesn't necessarily teach them how to build stuff properly in the first place. So what do you do about that?
I think you're right about that. And for the courses that I've been teaching, I mean, if you look at industry, and I believe Sigital is doing a bunch of great work in this space too, like the amount of education involved in how to design secure software, you know, that's pretty intense.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me, I have students for one 10-week quarter, because we're on the quarter system, and I'm trying to figure out, like, what is the highest impact that I can have in teaching these students about security?
Right.
What I tell them is, you know, if I focus on one specific technology, like cross-site scripting or buffer overflow, you might learn the technology, but in 10 years, that knowledge might be dated. If instead I can teach you to...
Or it might only apply to cars.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. If instead I can teach you to have a security mindset to know when there might be an issue so that you can bring in a more current expert, you know, I feel like I've done my job for that course.
Yeah.
And so for my course, my goal is to teach people to know when to involve someone in security, and then the security experts will then help with the, you know, the actual design or evaluation of that system.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not necessarily expecting that everyone from this course is, you know, fully equipped to go it solo, so to speak.
Oh, of course, of course. So this internet of broken things, you heard it here first, seems particularly rife with invasion of privacy stuff versus sort of more spectacular hacking. And privacy's not quite as sexy, like knowing if somebody's home by their power consumption, for example. What do you think we can do to get people to understand the kind of privacy invasion that a lot of these products involve versus taking control and making their brakes go off?
That is a really tough question. And, you know, I would actually break it down into several parts. One is both understanding the potential privacy invasion and then kind of embodying it or carrying it with them so they actually respond to it.
Right.
You know, one of the examples I like to give is when, you know, Facebook changes their privacy policy. You know, there's a people, I think, understand the change, or many people do, and there's a lot of public outcry. And then, you know, a few weeks later, you know, kind of the buzz has disappeared and people are, you know, now using Facebook again and kind of forgotten about this privacy change. So,
right.
So making people aware of it and, you know, having some sort of action upon it. And I must admit, I don't know, it's hard to know exactly what the threat is, exactly what the level of risk is. I do know, for example, that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is actually very interested in privacy.
Yeah. Well, this is thanks to, you know, Ed Felton and then Steve Belevin and so on.
Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We have real technologists at the FTC. That really helps a ton.
Yeah, no, actually, no. As you said, Ed Felton and Steve Belevin, you know, people who are experts in computer security and privacy and technology and so on. It's great having them there. You know, I'm not sure what the right path is. If it's whether through the consumer or whether it's through someone like the FTC,
mm-hmm.
and it's very, very hard also to know exactly what the risks are with privacy for these emerging technologies.
Yeah, and frankly, some people feel it's worth the trade-off even if they're aware of the risks. For example, those grocery store cards that get you, you know, $2 off your purchase, but result in a huge database of everything you ever bought.
Yep.
And there's some people that are like, well, hell, that's worth $2. Who cares?
Yeah. No, it's
they even know it. I mean, so people make different decisions too. I wanted to push on something slightly different, and that is when you break these things and you go back to the people that built it and you say, hey, we broke it this way. Have you been able to show how products have improved because of your work?
Yes, I think actually we have. And so I will say that different industries respond in different ways. And so we've looked at a large number of things. We've looked at, you know, home automation systems. We've looked at medical devices. We've looked at children's toys. We've looked at automobiles. The automotive industry has had an incredibly positive response. Like,
uh-huh.
I am really, really impressed.
That's great.
So the U.S. Society of Automotive Engineers, I think they actually changed their name, but Society of Automotive Engineers created a new task force focused specifically on computer security and privacy for vehicles. I know that a number of manufacturers have significantly ramped up their efforts, you know, with lots of hiring and security. I know that it takes time to re-engineer future automobiles, but I know they're really proactively thinking about security. I know that a number of things were, happened specifically in response to our results to address specific things that we identified. I know that, for example, the U.S. National Highway Transportation Safety Administration's focus on security is kind of as a result of the work that we did. So
yeah, and you probably helped them to get a clue. I mean, one of the issues that we suffer from in our discipline is people gleefully breaking stuff and then just saying, okay, well, good luck fixing it.
Yeah, and I would say that it is actually much easier to find vulnerabilities and break things than to fix things.
Absolutely.
And as you say, it's kind of our responsibility to do some sort of follow through. And
I know that you teach ethics in as part of your course, and I actually know that you have a very strong personal code of ethics, which is something that others should try to emulate. You should be proud of that. But the question is whether or not that ethics lesson that you teach students should also include, listen, if you break it, you need to help people fix it too.
I think that's a great thing to do. I mean, it's, you know, there's a, I agree with you completely. With the caveat that we should be available to help people fix it. But sometimes they actually don't want our help. So, for example,
right.
There are a number of industries that care significantly about intellectual property, and you know they will work on trying to address the vulnerabilities that we find, but they kind of want to do it themselves.
Yeah, and they'll probably screw it up too.
There are risks, as you know, with you know without having a you know kind of you know external vetting of security solutions. But I agree with you completely. I think that we should be available to help. And you know, if they let us help, then definitely we can help them.
So I want to switch gears and open a big can of worms for like the next 1 minute and 30 seconds. What is your view of the Snowden revelations and Dragnet surveillance and the way technology is trending now? I mean, you guys got involved by analyzing the dead drop system, for example.
Yes, we did analyze that. You know, I would say that you know, kind of the Alexey Cheskis and some of the other people on the team really drove that effort. it's hard for me to step back and think about, you know, all these revelations and know, you know, kind of crisply what I feel. But one of the things that I think that security researchers have for a long time known that these types of things are possible. And so I don't know if my worldview has changed, you know, changed significantly.
Right.
But I do think that it is kind of a, you know, we're seeing a lot more interest in computer security and privacy, which I think is good for the security and privacy community. You know, people are kind of, you know, more demanding of the security technologies out there.
So we still have some philosophical lessons to learn, but we haven't had time for that to sink in yet.
You know, other people might have been following those issues much better than I have. So I'm probably not the best person to comment on that, no.
So, all right, I'll give you a softball then.
Thank you.
What kind of security education should all engineers and designers be forced to take?
That is a great question. So for me, I think threat modeling and security mindset. And we actually created a new toolkit at the University of Washington with this goal in mind. We originally called them the Security and Privacy Threat Discovery Cards. Now we're calling them the Security Cards. And they're, you know, if you go to securitycards.cs.washington.edu, there's a free PDF you can download and print these cards.
Mm-hmm.
And these cards are designed to help people brainstorm about and learn about kind of threat modeling and who the adversaries might be and what the adversary targets are and so on.
Is that related to the Control-Alt-Hack thing?
No, Control-Alt-Hack was a game that we did a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And then the security cards are something completely different.
Ah.
So for the security cards, we have basically four suits. One is adversary method, the other is adversary motivation, the other one is adversary resources, and the other one is human impact. And the idea, and we actually targeted this, for example, for AP computer science courses. So someone who just has a very cursory introduction into computer science can get some exposure to security. But we also targeted for things like, you know, industry and training as well. So it's a broad selection of things. But in this, on these cards, and if someone goes to the website and looks at it, or I can talk through them, we have like a human impact suit, and there's a bunch of things in the human impact, like emotional well-being, financial well-being, physical well-being, relationships, society, biosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a bunch of things in like the attack, you know, adversary methods, like attack cover-up, indirect attack, multi-phase attack, and so on. And the idea is that there are several ways of using these cards, but one of the ways of using them is to present people with an example system. Maybe it's a system that they're working on in industry, or maybe it's a, you know, concocted system that we've created for the purpose of the class.
Right, and it helps them think through the possibility space.
That's right. And so, like, for example, we can say, now take this system and sort the adversary motivations cards based
right.
on terms of applicability. And so people start to think about, like, well, what might attackers want to do and why? We can also look at pairings between cards. So, for example, if I pick up the adversary motivation card, you know, which might be a good one, I don't know, you know, desire or obsession, you know, pick up that adversary motivation card and then pick up a human impact card on personal data, you know, how might these two cards relate to the system that we're analyzing?
Yeah, that's so good. That's really interesting. We'll have to put a link to that stuff. So,
yeah. And we have funds from NSF to give them, you know, give away the copies that we printed to educators. So if there are any educators listening, yeah, just send us a note and we will send you some copies of the cards.
Just a few thousand.
So, yeah, exactly.
So the last question, more of a personal question, since you got two little boys, what is your favorite children's book of all time so far?
Favorite children's book of all time? Well, it's hard for me to remember, you know, of all time, but I think that recently we've been reading Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Uh-huh.
So, but that's the one that first pops in my mind that I've, you know, every year we bring it out and
yeah.
I read it. And you know, I think there's been lots of very good books. But that's...
My little brother Chris was absolutely terrified of the clatter.
Oh!
Thought that the clatter was a thing instead of a noise.
That's funny. That's really funny.
Yeah.
You know, the book that we have, and I don't know, remember the author, but has some really amazing illustrations. And so kind of it's a book that I love going through and we love going through because of both the kind of the story, but then also just the pictures are very, very rich and colorful.
Yeah, cool. Well, that's a great answer. Well, thanks, Yosh. This has been very, very interesting. We could talk for another hour easily.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. And yeah, thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue devoted to healthcare IT. The issue also features our interview with ISC Squared Executive Director Horde Tipton. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.